Hello and welcome to another USA Hockey Magazine podcast. I'm Harry Thompson, editor of USA Hockey Magazine. Today we have the great fortune of being joined by John Van Beesbrouck, one of the greatest goaltenders of all time to play in the National Hockey League. In 2007, John was elected into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame, and last year he was unanimously chosen to serve as the Vice President of Junior Hockey on the USA Hockey Executive Board. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's good to be with you, Harry.
It's been a little more than a year since you've taken over that role. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how it's been for you serving in this capacity.
Well, it's been a challenge just to get to know a lot of the history of what's gone on in junior hockey and how the junior council has dealt with certain matters. So, you know, there's a learning curve there for sure. And then, you know, how the makeup of it is chosen by our president, Ron DiGregorio, and the expectation level of what's expected in order to, you know, have some civil disagreements and some good debate, and which can lead to a great forum, and that's to come out with some decision making in order to progress in the junior realm. I think that for the most part, I got up to speed pretty quick on that, working with a great partner in Mark Boxer, who's the junior liaison. You know, it's we get a lot of support from all the realms, you know, from Jimmy Johansson, you know, David Ogren, and of course with Ron. You know, junior hockey is, I think, reshaping itself right now. There's a lot of challenges right now out in the East, not only at the junior level, but just at the age-appropriate levels, especially at one that kind of interweaves with junior hockey, and that's the midget level. So we want to support our partners in youth. You know, one of the initiatives that I think has gone well so far is supporting the 16-year-old age bracket, so to speak, 16U or U16. It depends on which side of the 16 you're on. But, and that's because, you know, we want to support our partners in youth from the standpoint that it's very difficult for 16-year-olds, let alone 15-year-olds, to play junior hockey, and that that's an important age. But the 15-year-old waiver in the past, there was 120 of them requested and granted 2 years ago. This year we had 60, and hopefully next year we have you can count them on one hand as an exception to the rule, so that we support our youth partners better.
So these kids would stay within, mostly living at home and playing for more of a local team before going on to make that big jump into junior hockey?
Right. I mean, ultimately there's a range of dynamics there, but we want to support a very important age group, and that is 16 and under hockey. It's vital. We know that people have representation at that time. Mm-hmm. We know that in a lot of cases a 15-year-old can be, you know, older and mature, but as far as hockey maturity, probably better to dominate at the 16U level than it is to just be another face in junior hockey. And I think that's an important part to development. You know, I'm getting to understand the development of that a little bit more. I mean, even though I played pro and all the rest of it for a long period of time, you don't know what's going on in all the marketplaces.
Right. You talked a little bit about reshaping of junior hockey. What are some of the other biggest changes that are taking place within the whole dynamic?
I'd have to say that it depends on the region, but the reshaping of it is from the aspect that we have two main groups. One is a non-pay-to-play group, right, mm-hmm. which is our Tier 1 is USHL, and Tier 2, which is North American Hockey League. And then we have the pay-to-play model, which is our Tier 3 level. And within our Tier 3 level, we have more hockey players. But, you know, there's a player pool that's got to match. Mm-hmm. And I think the reshaping comes at the player pool matching. You know, number one is what we're doing at the top level, at the USHL level, and also supporting the national program. And then two is at the Tier 2 level and how that interrelates. And then the Tier 3 level, so we you know, start calling it something that has development with it, and that's the ladder of development.
Right.
Right now there's been some log jams, there's been some mistrust, and some players haven't advanced or advanced too quick. So, you know, with the marketplaces sometimes in flux, all those things in that dynamic have a tendency to create its own problems, and what we're trying to do is just trying to simplify that that growth.
I know that a lot of attention, and maybe, I don't know, rightly so, because they do such an excellent job, is focused on the North American League and the United States Hockey League. What are some of your thoughts on how those two leagues in particular are developing players for that next step, mostly to go onto the college ranks?
Yeah, well, in the North American League, you know, you have a 24-team league, and it's a challenge because they're vastly located, you know, from Alaska down to Texas up to the northern part of Michigan and not quite in the east. So it's quite a vast territory for travel partners, and that's a challenge. But in relation, you know, there's a lot of players getting opportunity and being developed with some real strong partners. And with that comes a Grow the Game initiative, you know, which we can't lose sight of, is the fact, like, junior teams in Texas and, you know, up to Aberdeen in South Dakota and then over to, I mean, what a vast area that is, and what a great way to acknowledge the Grow the Game initiative in some of these marketplaces. But, you know, where the players come from is starting to advance, and they're actually coming homegrown from places like Texas and Los Angeles and, you know, Colorado and places that aren't your traditional Minnesotas and Bostons and Michigan and Illinois. So that's great, and I think that the North American Hockey League has really advanced that. With that comes the USHL, which has done a remarkable job, I think, of staying tight and not growing too fast, and keeping the player pool very, I don't want to say accelerated, but when you look at their numbers of putting in excess of 300 kids into D1 schools every year, you'd have to say that's a big accomplishment. With that comes then the next step to the national program and how it intertwines within that league. I think there's a lot of benefit out there, and it makes USA Hockey and everybody involved in it feel like they're taking part in something that is progress.
No doubt. Well, this is something I was going to ask you down the road, but during your playing days, and you went to the Florida Panthers and led them to a Stanley Cup final, your thoughts on the growth in Florida, particularly from when you were down there to maybe what you see now, how youth hockey and hockey in general has grown in the Sunshine State?
You know, Florida has done a great job. I mean, there's more rinks, number one, and, you know, there's a couple junior teams down there now at the Tier 3 level, but you know, Florida is an interesting dynamic because it's such a long state, you know. So South Florida, where I played and with the Panthers, I think they've had a big impact on a pretty vast part of Florida. But then you get up to Tampa, where there's another team known as the Lightning, and they've done a great job of building some roots there. And then they take it up into the top part of Florida. And then, you know, when you look at the southern states, Dallas has done a wonderful job of growing the game. So I'd have to say, you know, coupled with the fact of expansion and into Florida, I think you'd have to deem it a success. I think the NHL has a big impact and helps, you know, not only create dreams for kids, but it's done a great job of selling the game.
Right. I understand you played hockey or junior hockey north of the border, and then had a 19-year NHL career. Just to get back to your role now with junior hockey, do you think that has all helped you, in addition to all the other things that you've done? How has that helped you, you know, as you sit in a room with these entrepreneurs and these people who are dedicated to putting the best product on the ice in their own community? How does that help you in your day-to-day serving as the vice president of junior hockey?
Yeah, I think that all your experiences, you know, they don't give you a diploma in hockey. Nobody gets a hockey diploma. Maybe one day there will be from maybe, you know, Colorado College here. But I think that you use all your experiences and everything you can in the world of, you know, this great game to try to bring to the table. But first of all, you know, I after I finished playing professionally, I, you know, invested in a junior club that I played for north of the border, and it gave me a great experience. It was a short-term experience, but, you know, I benefited from learning that system and what's involved both politically, you know, financially, and then collectively down to the dynamic of player development and how important it is at each channel to treat it with humility and with, you know, not with indignance, but with, you know, ethics, how you could have a respectful disagreement on some subjects and do it in a way where you have a benefit come forward. And I think that what happens is a lot of times we draw a stark contrast and just want to do some fist pounding and maybe do an old-fashioned motivational speech from a coach. Well, that doesn't go very far when you've got, you know, 25 owners in a room and they're all looking at you like, you know, John, we just want to advance the ball a little bit down the road here. We don't need to be motivated to go play a game. And so you have to separate yourself from your playing days to understanding that people want to be treated, you know, friendly, number one, and they want to be treated equitably. And they want your experiences to come forward as a push forward.
I would also imagine that them knowing that you have been in their shoes must also be a little bit of a comfort to them, or at least to them to know that you understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of challenges at the junior level, not only from, you know, creating clarity to the player of what the expectations are, but clarity to parents, you know, that have put so much time in their young individual, and then they got to hand them off to maybe a place unknown to them. But you're right, when it comes to actually dealing directly and not indirectly, it's good to know. I mean, I think it's good for them to know that I've experienced some similar situations, and I do it from the fact, like, I don't have any personal agenda or any personal motivations into this other than to make the game better.
That leads to another question. I know that you're involved in other things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find the time to juggle all these things? I mean, you know, I know we all think of you, you know, people such as yourself who played so long in the NHL to be retired, but it doesn't seem like retirement's is much of a kicking back and relaxing thing for you.
No, I don't think I'll ever be retired. I think that, you know, that retirement, I guess, word related to hockey careers isn't really accurate, you know. I mean, because we use that word in relation to our parents who worked hard for their whole life and then have retirement at 65 years old. And here I am, I'm 49, going to be 50 in September, and I don't view myself as old, mm-hmm. even though my kids tell me I am. But I don't also view myself as retired. I view myself into switching careers, and I'm really challenged by, you know, this position, not only from the fact that, you know, it's dealing with so many people, but finding the time to really balance a life.
Absolutely. Are you still involved with Fast Hockey?
Yeah. When I took this position, I stepped down from all my operational positions because it would have been a conflict in my view. So that was the first step. But, I mean, I'm a partner. Mm-hmm. And some things, you know, need to be bounced off me from time to time just on, you know, are we in the right channel? It's the same experiential type of questions that come. But Fast Hockey's grown and supported the grandparent, parent, and player.
Right.
Proud of that because, you know, it's not just a fan experience type of thing. It's so people can see their son or daughter play in some faraway places, and when you can hook up with USA Hockey and do the national tournament at all the levels, I mean, watching it on a tablet or a smartphone, it's the new age.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask is how proud you are of how far Fast Hockey has come, and I know that they'll be broadcasting every game from this year's USA Hockey National Championships coming up in just about a month.
It's a big factor for, you know, for the benefits of family, you know, and I think that we look at ourselves, the people that are involved in it are from the hockey family. Mm-hmm. Everybody involved has participated either at the major level or in some way high school. And we try to, you know, have the people that are out there working in the marketplace having had some type of attachment or a love for the game. And then understand, obviously, computers and the way that channel has to be worked. But, you know, we have a great support team. Very proud of, you know, having a partnership with Mark Reskin, my partner, who lives in Boston. And we basically just communicate by phone. So mm-hmm. It's we live vicariously through watching games.
Right. No, absolutely. It's great. But I also know that you're also involved in you have several charitable causes that are near and dear to your heart. Can you just talk a little bit about some of the charities that you lend your time and efforts toward?
I mean, one of the charities is the Alan T. Brown Foundation to find a cure for paralysis. I've had a golf tournament in New York, New Jersey area for this will be, I believe, our 24th year, which is Alan got injured down in Florida at a young age, and you know, he was 21 years old, got flipped by a wave, a very unusual circumstance, and now is the director of the Christopher Reeve Foundation. And so I think we've raised, not just with the golf tournament, but other events to support, you know, the quality of life for people in wheelchairs in excess of, you know, $15 million or so in that time period. And so, you know, there's a political element to it, you know, because of quality of life for people that have sustained long-term injury like that. And I'm sure the people that have watched hockey in the past know some of the people that have been injured in the rink and have had long-term injury, and we have raised a lot of money for them, whether it's Jack or whomever. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that people look at hockey, that when you're playing a physical game, this could be one of the outcomes. And, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I've stuck with it, you know, myself personally and my family, and that we've enjoyed some meeting some people and getting to know the people in chairs and what their challenges are. So that one's probably near and dear to my heart the most.
Okay. One of the last things I just want to ask you about is in your role with junior hockey, you're near the top rung of the ladder when it comes to development in the United States. I wanted to just get some of your thoughts at some of the other development issues that are going on in the United States, how you think we're progressing, mostly at the bottom, and particularly as it pertains to the American development model.
It's very interesting to watch and to, you know, develop alongside of it, you know, because as we develop children develop us, mm-hmm. and how we approach, and in this kind of different culture that we live in now, is to try to keep the game progressing, and to watch a lot of the efforts that have gone in to know that it's important that everybody touches a puck, and that we learn these abilities of practicing and training and whatnot. You know, it kind of has gone against the grain of the old days of the way we just, you know, pick sides and played a good old game of shinny, which is still a part of that element. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, I'm having a conversation with Lou Verrill recently, just some of these concepts have been in place since, you know, middle 70s, and what they used to draw up on paper and send out to everybody. And it's good that we're focusing on that traditional type of value and how to train young players. And I think that USA Hockey carries a narrative now, which is significant to our channels, to our players, but to the rinks. And you know what? I mean, overcoming obstacles is going to be the biggest part of the success of the ADM. And I'm sure that, you know, nothing goes smoothly from the outset. We have talking to Mike Ayers with the National Development as a goalie coach and talking about backfilling a goalie program in the ADM. And let's put some thoughts in there to foot movement and some of the old Warren Strelo things that we have, and working with the Strelo program and how we bring that down to the young goalies so they're just not falling on their knees thinking that, you know, their holy goalie is just praying to be hit. So, you know, I think it's important for us to understand, and for people that are listening and watching and learning, that there's a lot of time and effort that goes into this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, John, thanks. Thank you for taking the time to, you know, talk to us today, and for all that you're doing to keep hockey going in the United States.
Thanks, sir.